Hey, it's Otis here. Before we get to the bedtime reading, I wanted to let you know that I just launched a brand new show. It's called The Daily Book Club, a daytime companion to Sleepy, where you hear entire books one chapter at a time, one day at a time. Simple as that. So if Sleepy is how you wind down your day, The Daily Book Club is a great way to start your day. There's new episodes daily. I read in a slightly peppier voice so that you can get really lost in these amazing stories that have stood the test of time. Or, just like Sleepy, you can sit back and relax and zone out to a good book. The first book we'll be reading is The Enchanted April by Elizabeth Von Arnim. Story is, in the 1920s, four women unfulfilled with life take a chance and abscond to a dreamy medieval Italian castle. It's a story dripping with wisteria, the beauty of solitude, and an unlikely pursuit of joy in Portofino, Italy. I think that this is a perfect story for the season, and you can hear it now. Find the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. This show has been a long time coming, and I'm so excited to bring you even more stories. So go subscribe to the Daily Book Club to hear what happens next. Thanks.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, my name's Otis Gray, and you're listening to Sleepy. A podcast where I read old books to help you get to sleep. And this is a midweek bedtime story for you. So today, I'm going to be reading the part two of a story we started last week on last Wednesday. It was kind of a longer short story, so I figured I'd break it into two. So tonight, we're going to be hearing part two of Love of Life by Jack London, part of his short story series, To Build a Fire. And again, this is a little bit straying away from what we usually read on Sleepy, since Jack London is slightly more... graphic would be the word, but his writing is objectively just gorgeous, and it really is a pleasure to read. He's a great author to read in the daytime, and if you liked this Jack London reading, please let me know in a response on Spotify or in a review on Apple Podcasts. Would love to know. Well, anyways, as always, these Wednesday stories are going to be shorter and have a beginning, middle, and end, and our regular episodes will keep happening every Sunday, where I can thank all of our patrons on patreon.com, which is a website where you can go and pledge a couple bucks for an ad-free version of the show. So that is patreon.com/sleepyradio, and I'll have a link for that in the show notes in case you want to be a part of making the show. And also, I am so overwhelmed by the support and reviews for the new podcast that I just launched this past Sunday, The Daily Book Club, where I read books one chapter at a time, one day at a time. Thank you all so, so much for going and listening. I really, really appreciate it. The Enchanted April is an incredible story. And doing this daytime show as a daytime companion to Sleepy, it's been a long time coming. So thank you so much for helping right out the gate. I really, really appreciate it. And if you're listening and you haven't heard it, you can go find the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else for even more story content. So before we get to tonight's episode, as always, a quick shout out to the music, which is by my good friend James Lepkowski, and the cover art, which is by the one and only Gracie Cannon. So tonight, this is part two of the short story, Love of Life, by Jack London. And now is the time for you to fluff up your pillow just how you like it. Feel yourself melt into your bed. Get real comfortable. Close your eyes. And let me read to you. Day came. A gray day and no sun. It had ceased raining. The keenness of his hunger had departed. Sensibility, as far as concerned, the yearning for food, had been exhausted. There was a dull, heavy ache in his stomach, but it did not bother him so much. He was more rational, and once more he was chiefly interested in the land of the little sticks and the cache by the River Dease. He ripped the remnant of one of his blankets into strips and bound his bleeding feet. Also, he re-cinched the injured ankle and prepared himself for a day of travel. When he came to his pack, he paused long over the squat moose-hide sack, but in the end it went with him. The snow had melted under the rain, and only the hilltop showed white. The sun came out, and he succeeded in locating the points of the compass, though he knew now that he was lost. Perhaps in his previous day's wanderings, he had edged away too far to the left. He now bore off to the right to counteract the possible deviation from his true course. Though the hunger pangs were no longer so exquisite, he realized that he was weak. He was compelled to pause for frequent rests when he attacked the muskeg berries and rush grass patches. His tongue felt dry and large, as though covered with a fine hairy growth, and it tasted bitter in his mouth. His heart gave him a great deal of trouble. When he had traveled a few minutes, it would begin a remorseless thump, 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 and then leap up and away in a painful flutter of beats that choked him and made him go faint and dizzy. In the middle of the day, he found two minnows in a large pool. It was impossible to bail it, but he was calmer now and managed to catch them in his tin bucket. They were no longer than his little finger, but he was not particularly hungry. The dull ache in his stomach had been growing duller and fainter. It seemed almost that his stomach was dozing. He ate the fish raw, masticating with painstaking care, for the eating was an act of pure reason. While he had no desire to eat, he knew that he must eat to live. In the evening, he caught three more minnows, eating two and saving the third for breakfast. The sun had dried stray shreds of moss, and he was able to warm himself with hot water. He had not covered more than 10 miles that day, and the next day, traveling whenever his heart permitted him, he covered no more than 5 miles. But his stomach did not give him the slightest uneasiness. It had gone to sleep. He was in a strange country, too, and the caribou were growing more plentiful, also the wolves. Often their yelps drifted across the desolation, and once he saw three of them slinking away before his path. Another night, and in the morning, being more rational, he untied the leather string that fastened the squat moose-hide sack. From its open mouth poured a yellow stream of coarse gold mist and nuggets. He roughly divided the gold in halves, catching one half on the prominent ledge, wrapped in a piece of blanket, and returning the other half to the sack. He also began to use strips of the one remaining blanket for his feet. He still clung to his gun, for there were cartridges in that cache by the River Dease. This was a day of fog, and this day hunger woke him again. He was very weak and was afflicted with a giddiness which at times blinded him, It was no uncommon thing now for him to stumble and fall. And stumbling once, he fell squarely into a ptarmigan nest. There were 4 newly hatched chicks, a day old, little specks of pulsating life no more than a mouthful, and he ate them ravenously, thrusting them alive into his mouth and crunching them like eggshells between his teeth. The mother ptarmigan beat about him with a great outcry. He used his gun as a club with which to knock her over, but she dodged out of reach. He threw stones at her, and with one chance shot broke a wing. Then she fluttered away, running, trailing the broken wing, with him in pursuit. The little chicks had no more than whetted his appetite. He hopped and bobbed clumsily along on his injured ankle, throwing stones and screaming hoarsely at times. At other times, hopping and bobbing silently along, picking himself up grimly and patiently when he fell, or rubbing his eyes with his hand when the giddiness threatened to overpower him. The chase led him across swampy ground to the bottom of the valley. Then he came upon footprints in the soggy moss. They were not his own. He could see that. They must be Bill's. But he could not stop, for the mother ptarmigan was running on. He would catch her first, then he would return and investigate. He exhausted the mother ptarmigan, but he exhausted himself. She lay panting on her side. He lay panting on his side, 12 feet away, unable to crawl to her. And as he recovered, she recovered, fluttering out of reach as his hungry hand went out to her. The chase was resumed. Night settled down and she escaped. He stumbled from weakness and pitched head foremost on his face, cutting his cheek, his pack upon his back. He did not move for a long time. Then he rolled over on his side, wound his watch, and lay there until morning. Another day of fog. Half of his last blanket had gone into foot wrappings. He failed to pick up Bill's trail. It did not matter. His hunger was driving him too compellingly. Only he wondered if Bill too were lost. By midday, the irk of his pack became too oppressive. Again, he divided the gold, this time merely spilling half of it onto the ground. In the afternoon, he threw the rest of it away, there remaining to him only the half blanket, the tin bucket, and the rifle. The hallucination began to trouble him. He felt confident that one cartridge remained to him. It was in the chamber of the rifle, and he had overlooked it. On the other hand, he knew all the time that the chamber was empty. But the hallucination persisted. He fought it off for hours, then threw his rifle open and was confronted with emptiness. The disappointment was as bitter as though he really had expected to find the cartridge. He plodded on for half an hour, when the hallucinations arose again. Again he fought it, and still it persisted, till for very relief he opened his rifle to unconvince himself. At times his mind wandered farther afield, and he plodded on, a mere automation, strange conceits and whimsicalities gnawing at his brain like worms. But these excursions, out of the real, were of brief duration. Forever the pangs of the hunger bite called him back. He was jerked back abruptly once from such an excursion by a sight that caused him nearly to faint. He reeled and swayed, doddering like a drunken man to keep from falling. Before him stood a horse. A horse. He could not believe his eyes. A thick mist was in them, intershot with sparkling points of light. He rubbed his eyes savagely to clear his vision, and beheld, not a horse, but a great brown bear. The animal was studying him with bellicose curiosity. The man had brought his gun halfway to his shoulder before he realized. He lowered it and drew his hunting knife from its beaded sheath at his hip. Before him was meat and life. He ran his thumb along the edge of his knife. It was sharp. The point was sharp. He would fling himself upon the bear. But his heart began its warring thump, thump, thump. Then followed the wild upward leap and tattoo of flutters and pressing as of an iron band about his forehead, the creeping of dizziness into his brain. His desperate courage was evicted by a great surge of fear. In his weakness, what if the animal attacked him? He drew himself up to his most imposing stature, gripping the knife and staring hard at the bear. The bear advanced clumsily a couple of steps, reared up, and gave vent to a tentative growl. If the man ran, he would run after him, but the man did not run. He was animated now with the courage of fear. He too growled, terribly, voicing the fear that is to life germane and that lies twisted about life's deepest roots. The bear edged away to one side, growling menacingly, himself appalled by this mysterious creature that appeared upright and unafraid. But the man did not move. He stood like a statue till the danger was past, when he yielded to a fit of trembling and sank down into the wet moss. He pulled himself together and went on, afraid now in a new way. It was not the fear that he should die passively from lack of food, but that he should be destroyed violently before starvation had exhausted the last particle of the endeavor in him that made toward surviving. There were the wolves. Back and forth across the desolation drifted their howls, weaving the very air into a fabric of menace that was so tangible that he found himself, arms in the air, pressing it back from him, as it might be the walls of a windblown tent. Now and again, the wolves, in packs of two and three, crossed his path. But they sheered clear of him. They were not in sufficient numbers, and besides, they were hunting the caribou, which did not battle, while this strange creature that walked erect might scratch and bite. In the late afternoon, he came upon scattered bones where the wolves had made a kill. The debris had been a caribou calf an hour before, squawking and running and very much alive. He contemplated the bones, clean picked and polished, pink with the cell life in them which had not yet died. Could it possibly be that he might be that ere the day was done? Such was life, eh? A vain and fleeting thing. It was only life that pained. There was no hurt in death. The die was to sleep. It meant cessation, rest. Then why was he not content to die? But he did not moralize long. He was squatting in the moss, a bone in his mouth, sucking at the shreds of life that still dyed it faintly pink. The sweet, meaty taste, thin and elusive almost as a memory, maddened him. He closed his jaws on the bones and crunched. Sometimes it was the bone that broke, sometimes his teeth. Then he crushed the bones between rocks, pounded them to a pulp, and swallowed them. He pounded his fingers, too, in his haste, and yet found a moment in which to feel surprise at the fact that his fingers did not hurt much when caught under the descending rock. Came frightful days of snow and rain. He did not know when he made camp, when he broke camp. He traveled in the night, as much as in the day. He rested wherever he fell, crawled on whatever the dying life in him flickered up and burned less dimly. He, as a man, no longer strove. It was the life in him, unwilling to die, that drove him on. He did not suffer. His nerves had become blunted, numb, while his mind was filled with weird visions and delicious dreams. But ever he sucked and chewed on the crushed bones of the caribou calf, the least remnants of which he had gathered up and carried with him. He crossed no more hills or divides, but automatically followed a large stream which flowed through a wide and shallow valley. He did not see this stream, nor this valley. He saw nothing save visions, Soul and body walked or crawled side by side, yet apart, so slender was the thread that bound them. He awoke in his right mind, lying on his back on a rocky ledge. The sun was shining bright and warm. Afar off, he heard the squawking of caribou calves. He was aware of vague memories of rain and wind and snow, and whether he had been beaten by the storm for 2 days or 2 weeks, he did not know. For some time, he lay without movement, the genial sunshine pouring upon him and saturating his miserable body with its warmth. A fine day, he thought. Perhaps he could manage to locate himself. By a painful effort, he rolled over on his side. Below him flowed a wide and sluggish river. Its unfamiliarity puzzled him. Slowly he followed it with his eyes, winding in wide sweeps among the bleak, bare hills, bleaker and barer and lower lying than any hills he had yet encountered. Slowly, deliberately, without excitement or more than the most casual interest, he followed the course of the strange stream toward the skyline and saw it emptying into a bright and shining sea. He was still unexcited. Most unusual, he thought. A vision or a mirage. More likely a vision, a trick of his disordered mind. He was confirmed in this by his sight of a ship lying at anchor in the midst of the shining sea. He closed his eyes for a while, then opened them. Strange how the vision persisted, yet not strange. He knew there were no seas or ships in the heart of the barren lands, just as he had known there was no cartridge in the empty rifle. He heard a snuffle behind him, a half-choking gasp or cough. Very slowly, because of his exceeding weakness and stiffness, he rolled over on his other side. He could see nothing near at hand, but he waited very patiently. Again came the snuffle and cough. An outline between two jagged rocks, not a score of feet away, he made out the gray head of a wolf. The sharp ears were not pricked so sharply as he had seen them on other wolves. The eyes were bleared and bloodshot. The head seemed to droop limply and forlornly. The animal blinked continually in the sunshine. It seemed sick. As he looked, it snuffed and coughed again. This at least was real, he thought, and turned on the other side so that he might see the reality of the world which had been veiled from him before by the vision. But the sea still shone in the distance and the ship was plainly discernible. Was it reality after all? He closed his eyes for a long while and thought, and then it came to him. He had been making north by east, away from the Dease Divide and into the Coppermine Valley. This wide and sluggish river was the Coppermine. That shining sea was the Arctic Ocean. That ship was a whaler, straight east, far east from the mouth of the Mackenzie, and it was lying at anchor in Coronation Gulf. He remembered the Hudson Bay Company chart he had seen long ago, and it was all clear and reasonable to him. He sat up and turned his attention to immediate affairs. He had worn through the blanket wrappings, and his feet were shapeless lumps of raw meat. His last blanket was gone. Rifle and knife were both missing. He'd lost his hat somewhere, with a bunch of matches in the band. But the matches against his chest were safe, and dry inside the tobacco pouch and oil paper. He looked at his watch. It marked 11 o'clock, and was still running. Evidently, he had kept it wound. He was calm and collected. Though extremely weak, he had no sensation of pain. He was not hungry. The thought of food was not even pleasant to him, and whatever he did was done by his reason alone. He ripped off his pants legs to the knees, then bound them about his feet. Somehow he had succeeded in retaining the tin bucket. He would have some hot water before he began what he foresaw to be the terrible journey to the ship. His movements were slow. He shook as with a palsy. When he started to collect dry moss, he found he could not rise to his feet. He tried again and again, then contented himself with crawling about on hands and knees. Once he crawled near to the sick wall, the animal dragged itself reluctantly out of his way, licking its chops with his tongue, which seemed hardly to have strength to curl. The man noticed that the tongue was not the customary healthy red. It was a yellowish brown and seemed coated with a rough and dry mucus. After he had drunk a quart of hot water, the man found he was able to stand, and even to walk as well as a dying man might be supposed to walk. Every minute or so he was compelled to rest. His steps were feeble and uncertain, just as the wolves that trailed him were feeble and uncertain. And that night, when the shining sea was blotted out by blackness, he knew he was nearer to it by no more than 4 miles. Throughout the night, he heard the cough of the sick wolf, and now and then the squawking of the caribou calves. There was life all around him, but it was strong life, very much alive and well, and he knew the sick wolf clung to the sick man's trail in the hope that the man would die first. In the morning, on opening his eyes, he beheld it regarding him with a wistful and hungry stare. It stood crouched, with tail between its legs, like a miserable and woe-begone dog. It shivered in the chill morning wind, and grinned despairingly when the man spoke to it in a voice that achieved no more than a hoarse whisper. The sun rose brightly, and all morning the man tottered and fell toward the ship on the shining sea. The weather was perfect. It was the brief Indian summer of the high latitudes. It might last a week. Tomorrow or the next day it might be gone. In the afternoon, the man came upon a trail. It was of another man, who did not walk, but who dragged himself on all fours. The man thought it might be Bill, but he thought in a dull, uninterested way. He had no curiosity. In fact, sensation and emotion had left him. He was no longer susceptible to pain. Stomach and nerves had gone to sleep. Yet the life that was in him drove him on. He was very wary, but it refused to die. It was because it refused to die that he still ate muskeg berries and minnows, drank his hot water, and kept a weary eye on the sick wolf. He followed the trail of the other man who dragged himself along, and soon came to the end of it. A few fresh-picked bones, where the soggy moss was marked by the footpads of many wolves. He saw a squat moose-hide sack, made to his own, which had been torn by sharp teeth. He picked it up, though its weight was almost too much for his feeble fingers. Bill had carried it to the last. Aha, he would have the laugh on Bill. He would survive and carry it to the ship in the shining sea. His mirth was hoarse and ghastly, like a raven's croak, and the sick wolf joined him, howling lugubriously. The man ceased suddenly. How could he have the laugh on Bill if that were Bill, if those bones so pinky white and clean were Bill? He turned away. Well, Bill had deserted him, but he would not take the gold, nor would he suck Bill's bones. Bill would have, though. Had it been the other way around, he mused as he staggered on. He came to a pool of hot water. Stooping over in a quest of minnows, he jerked his head back as though he had been stung. He had caught sight of his reflected face. So horrible was it that sensibility awoke long enough to be shocked. There were 3 minnows in the pool, which was too large to drain. And after several ineffectual attempts to catch them in the tin bucket, he forbore. He was afraid, because of his great weakness, that he might fall in and drown. It was for this reason he did not trust himself to the river astride one of the many drift logs which lined its sandpits. That day he decreased the distance between him and the ship by 3 miles, the next day by 2, for he was crawling now as Bill had crawled. And at the end of the fifth day, found the ship still 7 miles away, and him unable to make even a mile a day. Still the Indian summer held on, and he continued to crawl and faint, turn and turn about, and ever the sick wolf coughed and wheezed at his heels. His knees had become raw meat like his feet, and though he patted them with his shirt from his back, it was a red track he left behind on the moss and stones. Once, glancing back, he saw the wolf licking hungrily his bleeding trail, and he saw sharply what his own end might be, unless he could get the wolf. Then began as grim a tragedy of existence as ever was played. A sick man that crawled, a sick wolf that limped, two creatures dragging their dying carcasses across the desolation and hunting each other's lives. Had it been a well wolf, it would have not have mattered so much to the man, but the thought of going to feed the maw of that loathsome and all but dead thing was repugnant to him. He was finicky. His mind had begun to wander again and to be perplexed by hallucinations, while his lucid intervals grew rarer and shorter. He was awakened once from a faint by a wheeze close in his ear. The wolf leaped lamely back, losing its footing and falling in its weakness. It was ludicrous, but he was not amused. Nor was he even afraid. He was too far gone for that. But his mind was for a moment clear, and he lay and considered. The ship was no more than 4 miles away. He could see it quite distinctly when he rubbed the mist out of his eyes, and he could see the white sail of the small boat cutting the water of the shining sea. But he could never crawl those 4 miles. He knew that, and was very calm in the knowledge. He knew that he could not crawl but half a mile, and yet he wanted to live. It was unreasonable that he should die after all he had undergone. Fate asked too much of him, and dying, he declined to die. It was stark madness, perhaps, but in the very grip of death, he defied death and refused to die. He closed his eyes and composed himself with infinite precaution. He steeled himself to keep above the suffocating languor that lapped like a rising tide through all the wells of his being. It was very like a sea, this deadly languor, that rose and rose and drowned his consciousness bit by bit. Sometimes he was all but submerged, swimming through oblivion with a faltering stroke, and again by some strange alchemy of soul, he would find another shred of will and strike out more strongly. Without movement, he lay on his back, and he could not hear, slowly drawing near and nearer, the wheezing intake and output of the sick wolf's breath. It drew closer, ever closer, through an infinitude of time, and he did not move. It was at his ear. The harsh, dry tongue grated like sandpaper against his cheek. His hands shot out, or at least he willed them to shoot out. The fingers were curved like talons, but they closed on empty air. Swiftness and certitude required strength, and the man had not the strength. The patience of the wolf was terrible. The man's patience was no less terrible. For half a day he lay motionless, fighting off unconsciousness and waiting for the thing that was to feed upon him and upon which he wished to feed. Sometimes the languid sea rose over him, and he dreamed long dreams. But ever through it all, waking and dreaming, he waited for the wheezing breath and the harsh caress of the tongue. He did not hear the breath, and he slipped slowly from some dream to the feel of the tongue along his hand. He waited. The fangs pressed softly. The pressure increased. The wolf was exerting its last strength in an effort to sink teeth into the food for which it had waited so long. But the man had waited long, and the lacerated hand closed on the jaw. Slowly, while the wolf struggled feebly and the hand clutched feebly, The other hand crept across to a grip. 5 minutes later, the whole weight of the man's body was on top of the wall. The hands had not sufficient enough strength to choke the wall, but the face of the man was pressed close to the throat of the wall, and the mouth of the man was full of hair. It was not pleasant, and it was forced by his will alone. Later, the man rolled over on his back and slept. There were some members of a scientific expedition on the whale ship Bedford. From the deck, they remarked a strange object on the shore. It was moving down the beach toward the water. They were unable to classify it, and being scientific men, they climbed into the whale boat alongside and went ashore to see. And they saw something that was alive, but which could hardly be called a man. It was blind, unconscious. It squirmed along the ground like some monstrous worm. Most of his efforts were ineffectual, but it was persistent, and it writhed and twisted and went ahead perhaps a score of feet an hour. 3 weeks afterward, the man lay in a bunk on the whale ship Bedford, and with tears streaming down his wasted cheeks, told who he was and what he had undergone. He babbled incoherently of his mother, of sunny Southern California, and a home along the orange groves and flowers. The days were not many after that when he sat at the table with the scientific men and ship's officers. He gloated over the spectacle of so much food, watching it anxiously as it went into the mouths of others. With the disappearance of each mouthful, an expression of deep regret came into his eyes. He was quite sane, yet he hated those men at mealtime. He was haunted by a fear that the food would not last. He inquired of the cook, the cabin boy, the captain, concerning the food stores. They reassured him countless times, but he could not believe them, and pried cunningly about the lazarette to see with his own eyes. It was noticed that the man was getting fat. He grew stouter with each day. The scientific men shook their heads and theorized. They limited the man at his meals, but still his girth increased and he swelled prodigiously under his shirt. The sailors grinned. They knew. And when the scientific men sat to watch the man, they knew too. They saw him slouch forward after breakfast, like a mendicant, with outstretched palms, accost a sailor. The sailor grinned and passed him a fragment of sea biscuit. He clutched it avariciously, looked at it like a miser looks at gold, and thrust it into his shirt bosom. Similar were the donations from the other grinning sailors. The scientific men were discreet. They let him alone, but they privately examined his bunk. It was lined with hardtack. The mattress was stuffed with hardtack. Every nook and cranny was filled with hardtack. Yet he was sane. He was taking precautions against another possible famine. That was all. He would recover from it, the scientific men said. And he did, ere the Bedford's anchor rumbled down in San Francisco Bay. Thank you for listening to Sleepy. Good night.